Janice stared in until Bradley came and began to run ahead of them. His father caught him up, and then they all went forward, hesitantly, into the beautiful place. There were many empty benches at the back, and they slipped into one of them, looking around for fear they had made a mistake. They sat bolt upright, unnaturally alert, watching across the aisle at the talk flying back and forth, the eager, expressive faces, the smiling. Janice found her attention caught by a young man who was sitting ahead and to one side of her. He was leaning around the corner of the bench to talk to a girl smiling at him across the aisle. Their faces were closed to anything but each other, their hands moving in shared rhythm to the most common daily thoughts. They were in a single daydream together, and they spoke a daydream sign. "My sister got a new coat. Can you come to the picnic Thursday? How is your mother?" Janice watched them being pulled toward each other by a force as compelling as the need to breathe. It was not God that made them come to this church every Saturday, but their hands, aching and impatient to trade the simplest words in the true and natural language. Janice found herself remembering with a dull envy her own days of that insatiable hunger. The waiting and waiting until Abel came to look for her words. The force that drove her to share all the meaningless, ordinary happenings of the day with him. The understanding, sudden and complete, that lit in his face and eyes and made his newly learned sign stutter as he answered. Now he sat on the other side of the children, blind to the shame she felt at her poverty and theirs. Even the smell they carried on them was of close, rank places, of being poor. She was ashamed to be with these people, though they were her own kind and speakers of the true language. Then a minister came out from a door to the side of the raised place, stood at a high, thin table, and began to speak to them. He used a slow and formal sign, heavy with vowels, nothing left out. It was sign that had not been picked up in the half-darkness of corners, cloakrooms, and bathrooms. It was not for those places or those words. It reminded Janice instead of the judge words coming from the interpreter when they had been in the court. She caught a kind of matching, or rhyming of the symbols, and a long swinging rhythm in the rise and fall of the words. The beauty of them left her open-mouthed. She found herself gaping like someone who was simple-minded, and her eyes bore in upon him, taking every motion, each pause and shade of movement. Never had she seen such beauty in the simple act of speaking. That this was her language, the language of her affliction, made her weak with awe. Now he was speaking of what he called the things not seen. He spoke often of Christ's wishes for mankind and of mankind's responsibilities. When he was finished, Janice found herself strained from having leaned forward so. The minister blessed them all, and then everyone prayed. Following his prayer, and Janice trembled, taking from his hands the full, exquisite words. But when the service was over, they were only themselves again. The congregation filed out, talking to one another about unknown people and different things, looking past the newcomers in the indecency of their poverty. Janice pulled the children up quickly and escaped with them, going almost at a run past the knots of people talking in the front room and gathered on the steps. Outside in front of the church, she looked around desperately. Abel was nowhere to be seen. More and more people were coming out to stand talking in the sunlight. There was nowhere she could go to be lost, nothing to do to make herself less alone. She began a quick, nervous nagging to Margaret, and her stuttering made the girl hand-shy and frightened. "You didn't want to tell us what those people were saying about us this morning. You are not a help at all. Look at what happened to Bradley here. He could have gotten lost or been taken away by someone just because you are too lazy to see where he is and make him obey." Margaret had a half-knowledge that the scolding wasn't real, only a way of saying something that might bring an answer from her. But in all of it, there was nothing to say. And her hands only fumbled with nothing or with bits of answers, excuses, and apologies from other days, remembered without thinking. As the mother's scolding went on, a slow feeling of outrage began to rise in Margaret, and she saw it rising in Janice also. She knew that Janice would not hit her on the street, and so, because there was nothing else she could do, she turned her eyes away, seeking distance, a rest from the looming of Janice's face. Across the street, some children were standing in a row, their fingers idly poking in their noses or twisting strands of hair, hypnotically unconscious of themselves. Their eyes were fixed on these strange adults in their silence, drawing the quick pictures with their fingers, thrusting their hands out this way and that, their faces mobile and expressive, their hands more rapid than the eye could follow. No ordinary adult faces were ever so alive in the public pose of outside. Margaret saw the children watching. She began staring back, but the children didn't move or notice. They stood rooted at the curb, their stomachs stuck comfortably forward, dresses hiked over their childish pot bellies, faces dirty and rapt, eyes unmoving. She wanted to throw something at them to break their trances. Bradley was beginning to get restless. He hopped on one leg and then on the other and announced in his loud voice that he had to go piss. Heads turned around to stare at them, children mostly, the hearing children of the congregants. Margaret, trembling with embarrassment, took him quickly around the corner. They crept furtively into someone's backyard, and Bradley relieved himself against a tree. Then they walked back very slowly. Bradley was happy, stooping to pick up leaves and bugs and empty seed pods from the sidewalk. Margaret dawdled so as to spend as little time as possible at the front of the church. When they returned, Abel was there and the crowd had thinned. The children across the street were gone also, leaving an emptiness in the place where they had stood, so that Margaret's eye returned there more than once, and she was angry at the space which had, by contact, become unpleasant. It was easy to see that Abel was happy, pleased with the outing and delighted with himself for thinking of it. Janice seemed more sour than usual. As they walked back toward the trolley line, Margaret saw her mother's hands moving nervously, picking at each other and making tiny, unreadable signs behind the handbag bounding on her arm. She was muttering to herself without realizing it. She hated people to mutter sign to themselves and had slapped both the children for doing it. Occasionally, Janice's lips moved slightly in sympathy with her fingers, but never formed a word. As they came to the trolley line, her hands erupted at Abel. "Where were you?"
"I was with a man, talking."
"You left us standing there in front of that place for everyone to stare at. I told you we didn't have the clothes to wear. I know they thought we were beggars. Didn't you see those people staring at us?"
Abel's hands were quiet, but his shoulders were tightened in a way Margaret had never seen before. And when he spoke, his hands hummed in the air.
"I talked with the minister. There are 5 people in the congregation who are printers. When I told them things, they knew. I said about wanting to get another shop. He said next week he would introduce me to some of the people there and ask them to tell me what places there are. He is a nice man, the minister. He is not a deaf. His wife is deaf."
"If he isn't deaf, why would he want to bother with deaf if he can hear? Look out that he doesn't try to get any money out of you. I don't like it there. I don't like the people there."
"Well," he said airily, "we are going to come back again next week anyway. The minister said our clothes didn't matter. I haven't spoken with people since I was in school. I want to have some friends."
They began to argue, and when the streetcar came, they forgot to stop. Margaret glued her attention to the sights outside the window as the streetcar rattled and swayed into motion and then picked up speed. The shadows were drawing long and the day was cooling. Beside her, Bradley sat, fighting sleep. Across the narrow aisle, her parents were spinning out violence, calling names, numbering the bones of old wars, absorbed in themselves and their anger. Margaret thought that perhaps she and Bradley, sitting as they were, would not be taken as the children of those people, but as strangers belonging to some other family. A mother and father beautiful and handsome, happy and hearing and untroubled. Bradley had been conquered. His head fell back and then over against Margaret, who had turned away toward the window facing the streets and houses and drawn shafts of sunlight that poured between them. The sight reminded her of the church, as it was while the service was going on when people's eyes weren't on them, and when the minister was speaking of God and love with his beautiful hands. She tried to find a word to think that would weigh the beauty of those hands. It was, she murmured to herself, like it was love. And after she said it, she couldn't remember if she had formed the words in sound or in sign.
8. They went to church every week after that, and soon the very regularity of their presence made them familiar enough to be greeted with a half-smile coming or going, or a nod as they were passed in the aisle. When Janice saw that there was no escape from Abel's will, she made up her mind to conquer the church as she had conquered the factory, steadily, slowly, and relentlessly. She bought outfits for all of them from the money she had saved. Margaret got a white linen dress whose stiffness made her feel like an ancient insect held prisoner in its shell. The dress wrinkled at a look. It was clammy against the body, and the unbound inner edges of the waist and collar pricked and itched. There were long white stockings and stiff black shoes, and before they went out each Saturday, Margaret's thick, dark auburn hair was pulled back and braided so tightly that she could scarcely blink her eyes. Bradley had dark knee pants and long stockings also, and under his jacket a soft shirt starched hard and a full ribbon tie also starched. Janice wore the kind of summer print dress she had seen the other women wear. It did not go well with her muted coloring and made her look more faded and somehow more threatening than ever. Abel wanted clothes like the ones he had bought in that long dead summer of wealth, but Janice waved him away and ordered a suit as close as she could find to the suits worn by the other men as they stood greeting one another at the church door. She had bought all of their clothes in anger, and some of it seemed to cling to the fabric of them, to the way they fit, so that wearing them seemed to make the family uneasy together, quick to anger and sudden quarreling. They were, however, the church clothes, and church was another enemy. They were armor. One day, two men came to the apartment, pushed a paper into Janice's hand, walked to the back room, and came out carrying the machine and its little table. Janice had Margaret read the paper, which said that the men were from the mill and were taking the machine, as anyone could see for himself. The mother stood behind the terrified girl, pushing and poking at her to make it right, to stop the men with words, to argue or curse until they put down the machine and went away. Without the machine, how would they live? She had paid her rental fee and brought back the pieces every week. Her record of rejects was the lowest at the mill, her work the best. Who had told lies about her to cause this? The man with the table put it down and pointed at the paper, gesturing and shouting, until he finally made Margaret understand. Pieces were not going to be done anymore. The unions wouldn't stand for it, and there was no way to protect the pieceworkers from union bullies. If she wanted to work, she would have to sign up at the mill again and do the work as a regular. The rates were a little higher at the factory, and there wouldn't be machine rental to pay. When Abel came home, Margaret and Janice met him, weeping with fear and rage. When they told the story, he knew there was nothing for Janice to do but to go back to the sewing floor at the factory. The mother hum of the machine left the heart of the house, and then Janice left, going out in the gray whiteness of early morning and coming home when it was dark. Margaret stayed alone with Bradley in the terrible silence of the vacant-hearted back room. She was 7 then. Most of her street friends had gone off to the school, a mysterious and forbidding stained stone place bigger than the church. It was 4 blocks away on Bisher Street, and she learned to tell the time by the flowing of the children. They moved left across the window before 9 in the morning. They ran right at a few minutes past 12. They came dawdling left again at a few minutes before 1, and they poured thickly, slowly, finally right to left after 3 o'clock. On cold days, Margaret and Bradley stayed inside, moving between the rooms, around and around, pushing the time before them. Sometimes they ran up and down the stairs or hid from each other in the hallways until the neighbors threatened them. In January, the empty store on the street floor of the building was rented. 5 carts came filled with fantastic treasures, wonders, marvels. Over the window, a sign was being painted, and inside, a man named Petrakis ran,
shouted at the movers and fussed with the display cases of his crowded wonderland. Margaret and Bradley were fascinated by the pawn shop. After a time of staring in at the door and a first shy meeting, the children stayed in the store most of the time, peering at the piles of old latches, kegs, old screws, musical instruments, clothes, clocks, lamps, jewels, and things for which there were no names. In the beginning, they had been frightened of Mr. Petrakis, but he didn't mind having them there. They were silent children. They seldom touched things and never upset them. At first, he had thought them feeble-minded, but in their silence there was a preternatural alertness to movement. They seemed to weigh the air for danger. They were like very small old people, grave, polite, and little fearful. He let them stay. On mild days, they went out in the streets, hand in hand, watching. Sometimes they walked past the school pretending that they went there and had just come out for some reason. When people walked past them standing there, Margaret hoped that they were mistaking her for a schoolchild. Once she thought of carrying some books with her when they went past the school, but there were no books in the house and she didn't know where to get any. Mr. Petrakis didn't have books. In school they gave out books. Everyone came home with them, throwing them in the air and stuffing them with papers on which marvelous things were written. Sometimes she tried to play with the children after school. She would threaten Bradley until he was too frightened to wander away, and then they would venture out together and wait at the edge of some game or other, hoping to be included. The games had changed, and the children had changed. They had been swept away from her into their new lives. Waiting in the jumping lines, they talked about Mrs. Dubin and Miss Parks. The range of their friendships had grown without her. Sometimes Mary Catherine or Lila was there to remember Margaret for jump rope or playing jacks, but more and more her friends were off somewhere, streets away, and she would have to go searching for them, dragging a complaining Bradley behind her up Vandalia and over to Moody or Warren or Bisher, where other friends, school friends, had taken them into other games, private and protected. Margaret and Bradley would stand aside, and so, as audience, they were tolerated while the elect boasted about their difficulties and the cruelty they knew and could withstand.
Mrs. Lethierry, she don't use no ruler to hit you. She got a paddle.
Mrs. Dubin, she got a paddle, and she could hit with it, too.
Listen, you know what happened in our class? These two girls, they hid in the cloakroom.
They were so worldly, so powerful and fearless that Margaret was humble beside them and drew them into talk when they were willing. She collected and cherished every scrap of the day that they would share with her. Soon they stopped, knowing in their child-wise way that bare hints and silence were more effective than words.
They had to send a kid home today.
And then a grim nod and tight, righteous lips, and silence. And for days after, Margaret would pass the school and listen for screaming from any casually opened window. One day in March, Mr. Petrakis called Margaret to come to him, and she walked slowly to the counter where he sat guarding the cash register in his hunched-over way. Looking out from the counter, a person saw only the backs of things. Their fronts were facing the window. It gave her an odd feeling.
"Hey," he said. "A man come in today. He said he was a truant officer from the school."
He looked at her straight on, a thing hearing did not often do. She didn't answer.
"He told me somebody turned in your name or something. You supposed to be in school?"
"I can't. I have to stay home with my brother."
"Listen, you better tell your folks then. He's maybe going to come back. They could get in trouble."
She and Bradley had been on their way out to play, but now, with the world gone suddenly dangerous, she turned, pulling Bradley around and giving Mr. Petrakis a silent nod. They went upstairs again, and it was a week before they ventured back into the streets. But the officer made no other visit, and Mr. Petrakis didn't mention it again. Margaret had decided not to tell her parents. She didn't know why she kept it from them. She was eager to go to school. She felt separated, younger, less fit for not going. But she couldn't bring herself to speak of it. For a while, the fear lingered that the officer would come and hold her responsible and maybe put her in jail, where she would be beaten with paddles like those used in the school. But soon it too faded. And then the summer came and released them. It was a night early in July. The children had been in all day because of the rain, a heavy, plodding, patient rain that drove itself down into the street and lifted the garbage of the gutters to the level of the sidewalk. There was water coming in under the sills and down the sashes, and as the darkness came on early, their boredom turned toward fear. Abel was late. He had never been so late. Janice, having just come in herself, looked about, annoyed and frightened. But Margaret and Bradley had borne the slow changes of the day minute by minute and were too nervous to stay in one place. They began to run back and forth between the two rooms, shouting. The street lights came on. The alleys darkened, and the lights made the streets seem darker outside their small orbits, colder and more lonely. People walked close to the stores, huddling themselves away from the rain. Now and then a man who looked like Abel would move into the rain-threaded light, only to go on the street and disappear into some other doorway. Below them, the reflection from Mr. Petrakis's store lights went out, and the children felt the enemy silence palpable in the room with them. They had stopped their own noise and were waiting in the dark. It frightened Margaret that silence could be frightening as the bully you knew was waiting for you around the corner when you went down with the milk money. In church, there was silence too, but it was filled with unsounding voices, with talk, laughter, and the greetings of the people. The minister held it also vast and grand in his blessing when he spread his voice hands wide. A long, full rhythm of pictures that made of the word God a bird or a wing of light flashing cleanly upward. The eye that saw it almost believed an ear was hearing the beating upward of that wing. Yet there was nothing, only silence. And here in the room, peering out the window, they were waiting alone, fragile as signs, listening to the silence come stalking them. Carts with iron-rimmed wheels clattered past and the night closed over them. Their sound was only a different kind of silence that soon faded. The children didn't speak, and because of the darkness, they didn't sign. When Janice had come home, she had lit the kitchen angrily, impatient that nothing had been done. "Where is your father?" "Don't know." With quick hands, their faces very white and garish in the yellowed-looking artificial light. "I'll have to get supper." And Janice began, tiredly. She slammed when she was angry, but the children were comforted by the hard sounds of the dishes and forks going down. Runk, runk, on the table. Abel came in at last, soaked and smiling, and began to tell them as soon as he closed the door. With his coming in, the light in the room sweetened and eased. "I left Webendorf today. At the book press when I showed my work, yes, yes," the man said, "and I was hired. Cotter, his name is, the new boss. The place is nice. Two art magazines, cards also. Duo Black. Good." His hands paused while he tried to show them what the word meant, how much richer and better it would be, how he saw himself working to make a beautiful picture instead of a sheet of advertising or a series of tickets to the Nickelodeon like the ones they had just finished at Webendorf's. Bradley began to blubber with relief, and while he was weeping, he wet himself, and then he stood, one shoe in the puddle, while his sobs of relief changed to anxious whining. Janice took down his wet drawers and sopped the puddle, and Margaret went and got his other pair. Before Janice could take them from her, Bradley had run to his sister, seeking the warmth of her neck for comfort, while he rubbed his nose dry against her collar. Over his head, Margaret caught the sudden sharp look of jealousy on her mother's face, and then a slower, duller sadness conquering it. Janice turned and went back to finish setting the table. Abel was still talking about the new place, the new press, the new boss, and Margaret nodded her head to show that she was watching dutifully and with a certain pity. At first it looked as though there would be some trouble over the garnishee, which even after the 10 years he had paid still had $1,100 and interest owing on it. But he was able to show Mr. Cotter that his debt would be no trouble and his work would be worth it. He began to bring home strike-offs of some of the things he did. Photographs of women posing in different kinds of clothes, a calendar with marvelous scenes from different parts of the country, some nudes that Janice threw away, though he tried to explain that they were not like women to the people, but like shapes of things, mountains or boulders or fruit that some people kept in dishes, not to eat, but only to look at. She told him he was crazy.
Dirty pictures, she said, waving her hand under her chin. If you save them, your mind will get all dirty. What would someone think to come up here if you will have them?
He didn't remind her that no one ever did come, and she burned the pictures and forgot about it. Abel had been at work for almost a year when he came home and told them that another deaf printer had been taken on, a young boy from Rhode Island. He was staying with his aunt, a hearing, and he was very lonely. This was what Abel guessed, he said, because the boy had been raised only to read lips and he had no sign. It meant that he couldn't talk easily with either deaf or hearing. Janice shrugged, but he kept at her, pushing and nagging her to let him invite the boy for dinner one night and to take him to the church with them.
No, as soon as he learns sign, he will gossip about this place and our clothes.
I want him to come. I will bring him soon, whether you want to or not.
I won't feed him then. I won't feed anyone who will only go away and tell everyone about us, and even make up stories about us.
He nagged and she sulked, refusing to talk, looking away when he began to talk about it. The gossip wasn't the thing she feared most, although she gave fearful descriptions of the lies the boy would carry. What she feared was something she could not give words to. But it had to do with the years of her piecework at the machine at home, and now in the field of machines at the factory. Somehow, the time had narrowed all of her life to the safe size of the working table, and to the rhythm that flowed without change in her fingers and through her body. So long ago that she could barely remember it, she had wished for more things than a person could count. Most of all, she had wished for change. In the deadening routine of school, she had yearned for change. She had married Abel to change, to keep changing, to renew with a different place, a different dress, a different street, tree, restaurant, picture, the unchanging captive self. Now she could only marvel at that dead girl. When fear mouthed unreadable words at her mind during the day, she turned away and lost thought in the rhythm of the machine. The routine of the seam, turn, seam, back, stitch, turn. The pulse of the machine saved her. In the days when the yearning would have made her spend her money, the rights of the machine had prevailed. Now the money was being saved, or would be saved if she didn't have to waste it on Abel's church adventure. Well, even that had become part of the order of the days. A guest was too new a thing, too much change. It was not safe to change unless there was a need for it. She would not change for nothing. When she thought of Abel's wild plans, she sometimes smiled to herself over the machine, knowing how powerful the rhythms were. He tries to change everything, she said in her mind, and the spool thread picked up the bobbin thread. Go on. Go and dress and be better and get new work and invite new ones in for supper if you are so smart. The order of the days and the hours will stop you. I will win in the end. The thread engaged. The needle picked its way and the seam drew its line on and on. But one day when she came home, Abel had done it, and the boy was there. There was nothing more to do. She left him smiling uneasily at the kitchen table while she took Abel to the back room.
What did you bring that dummy here for? He can't even talk.
He's learning. You know how fast people learn because it is so good to talk. Don't you remember how I learned? He makes me remember how I was when I couldn't talk or listen to anybody, and I learned it all when the teachers weren't looking.
What are we going to give him to eat? Now all the stores are closed. Anyway, I would have to have the extra money.
Don't we have something in the house?
Only the cold sausage from yesterday and some canned green beans left over.
Give us that then, and we can all share. She made a sign of disgust at him and turned back to the kitchen. The boy was still sitting there stolidly, wanting to smoke and not daring. After dinner, the two men sat in the kitchen talking slowly. The room was hot and stifled with cooking smells, and when Abel leaned over and opened the kitchen door, the boy breathed deeply in spite of himself, although his eyes never left Abel, from whom he was taking the signs that fed him. The window in the bedroom had been opened before, and a pleasant breeze began to move through. Janice stood over the sink, her back to the men. Margaret cleared the table and put the canned milk and leftover dinner in the cupboard. Her mother's back was angry. It wasn't hunched as it was when she was feeling put upon or sad. It seemed to come and go at odd, hard angles, the hips thrust out, the angle of shoulder and neck oddly belligerent. Janice could be very cruel in this mood. Margaret worked quickly and carefully, hoping to forestall any bitterness. When she was through with her clearing, she went to the sink and began to dry the dishes Janice had stacked on the sideboard. Bradley had found his place with the men and had been amusing himself by standing on their feet and staring into their faces. At first, they played with him, raising him up and down on their feet, but after a time, they only patted his head and he began to be bored. Sometimes Margaret let him play in the soapy water after the dishes were done, but this time she only pushed him away. Janice was careful to raise her eyebrow to Margaret to show she knew that the guest had made extra dishes and tableware. It would take more time to wash it all and put it away. Some guest. As soon as he learned enough, he would be all over here and there, eating other people's dinners and telling tales about the poverty of the people who had first been kind to him. When Bradley came around again, Janice butted him away lightly with her hip, and he went back toward the men who moved to let him by. The dishes were almost done. Margaret was reaching for a pot that Janice had begun to hand over from the water because it was too heavy to drain with the other dishes. With the front door open, she could hear all the sounds of running up and down the stairs, and from the kitchen above where the voices were loud and strident and other dishes rattled in other wash pans. For a moment, she was distracted, so that she missed Janice's hand and dropped the pot, watching it bang off the sink edge and clatter to the floor. Janice glared. A group of boys had come rushing down from the apartment upstairs, and very loudly, they too began to clatter and thump down to the street. Near the door, the two men sat motionless in their still world, listening to each other's hands. Then everything was suddenly very still. It made Margaret turn, and without any conscious meaning in her mind, began to look for Bradley, calling. And when her mother gave her a question, she only answered, "Bradley?" Bradley, the letter B, waved a little so they knew it was a name, and the men looked up at the motion. "Where is he?" They looked, and Margaret called in what was now a terrible silence throughout the house, a silence not heard by the others, who looked easily, tolerantly, in case he should be ripping the quilt to get at the filling again. At last, she remembered his having gone past the men, and she went out to the dim landing. Soon the adults were behind her, looking down the long, steep flight of stairs into the pale, shocked faces of the boys and the spectators who had begun to crowd in behind them. 9. The assistant parted the curtain and looked out briefly. There were three of them, a man and a woman dressed stiffly and absurdly in cheap summer clothes, and a scrawny little girl with matchstick arms and a tight face. He turned to the director. "Customers." The director smoothed his clothing and then opened the curtain, surprising them. He went forward to them with smoothly professional calm. The presence of that child was upsetting. A shame. When the voice came, it came from the child. A hard, dry voice, childishly nasal. It shocked him.
"Mister, we come to buy a box off of you."
"I beg your pardon."
Louder.
"We come to buy a box off of you, a dead box."
He looked past the girl in her weirdly gay clothes, appealing to the man behind her. The man only smiled slightly, an apologetic half-smile nodding toward the girl.
"The deceased?"
the director said, trying to look at no one, least of all the hard-elbowed child.
"Who is the deceased?"
"What?"
the little girl demanded. He repeated the question, and the woman tapped the child on the shoulder. She turned and began a flurry of gestures. Deaf and dumb. The director sucked at a broken tooth snagging at the side of his cheek.
"Well? Who is dead?"
"It's my brother, Bradley. He fell down the stairs, all the way down."
The director felt a bit of his control slipping away. He tried to move her.
"Your brother. A terrible tragedy. And I know you want more than just a casket for him.
You want a funeral, a lovely funeral. Everyone has a funeral.
The girl turned around again and made gestures. Parents. The girl again. Parents. The director noticed that the father's hands were swollen and bruised, and he pushed away the thought that the man might have beaten the child to death. Their fingers snapped with a crisp, objective speed. The girl turned back to him.
Nope, she said. Just a box.
How old was he? The director asked.
4 years.
The director pulled a chair around from its place against the wall. He sat down close to the hard little girl. He started easily, warmly, asking her age and grade in school. Nothing. She went as blank as the dummies behind her.
Look, he said, leaning closer. We could sell you a coffin, but that isn't really what you want. You loved your brother. You want to see him taken care of, don't you? Later, you and your poor folks here will want to go to the cemetery and lay fresh flowers on that little grave, and you will want to know that you gave that little boy the very best you could give.
The mother's hand had begun to drum on the child's shoulder again, hungry for knowledge. The child turned and flashed hands, and the director had a sudden sense of their minds, of a strange, strong intelligence pouring among them. Yet when the girl turned to him again, the light died and left only that oat-gray, stolid face and the dead voice.
We just want the coffin, mister.
The director got up and pulled the curtain between the waiting room and the display room. He could feel their expected shock at all the space, then the awe. It affected everyone that way. A small stained glass window had been set at the back of the room, and the sunlight was slowed and softened through it, so that it came gently and broke gently on all the polished wood and against the metal fittings of the caskets. There were so many and they were so big that the three people stood lost in the room and couldn't find the courage to move on to the purple carpet on which the director stood. He had gone ahead, speaking without realizing it, a routine, low-voiced hum of words from which Margaret could make no sense, and of which the bleak couple behind her were unaware. Janice was bothered about the flowers. She remembered that flowers were part of funerals. Maybe there should be flowers. But they had no money. If they didn't have flowers, would it be wrong to Bradley? Would people laugh at them and at him, too, for being their child? They all stood until the director sensed for their presence behind him, and not finding them there, turned and saw them still standing where they had been left. He sighed and, murmuring, went back to them. They were really deaf after all. How patiently they stood in that mouthlessness, that earlessness. He raised his hand and snapped his fingers, summoning them, and to that summons they came, the man still with his nervous half-smile that begged for mercy. Behind the grouping of top-priced caskets were the children's models. Parents with limited means often spent everything they had to assuage the anguish and guilt they felt at the death of a child. The small caskets were made with all the details poignantly in miniature. Tiny keys for tiny locks, little clasps pointing against softly gleaming wood in perfect scale. Even the carvings at the edges and under the lids were not simplified or changed, but only made smaller so that their monumental themes had the wistful unreality of playthings. Small urns, small willows, plinths, and pediments, all to fairy scale, as if they were only dollhouses in the world they promised. Janice and Abel walked among the beautiful boxes, hungering to touch those carvings, to run the tips of their fingers over the smooth, warm wood, the smoother, warmer silver, to go through touch into the carved gardens, the willow places, and the bower branches. Margaret's hand also moved for a minute, as though it would light on a cluster of ripe, rounded grapes at the corner of one of the coffins. But she raised it again quickly. Mr. Petrakis didn't like her touching the things on his counters. Neither there nor here could a touch make any of the things real, so that people might escape into them and out of the crude, hammering sorrow that had caught them up. She kept her arms crossed over her chest, her hands fisted, until they would need to speak. The director had turned and was beginning again in the familiar and comforting territory of his trade. He pointed out the features of the casket before him, craftsmanship, quality, durability, the satin lining, garish in an adult model, so much more fitting for a child. How much better the sweet, clear complexion of the young would be, brought out against such a color. Margaret watched him, even though she did not need her eyes to hear, and her hands picked feebly among the remembered fragments of all the words, the dozens and dozens of words. She had heard very few of the director's words in her life and had no sign for most of them. They had all flown away by now, their meanings trailing out behind them into shadow and loss. "How much was the box?" the parents asked.
"This one is $200.
In a moment, they had read the numbers in Margaret's fingers, and their shock needed no translation. The director's tone of wounded sensibility missed them.
"I can, of course, show you others."
"To 100, to 50, to 35.
"One has to expect to spend some money."
"To 25. Others, even the poor, vacillated, picked and wept and picked again, thought and thought better as the love words were re-evoked and the bones of guilt picked clean. These dumb mouths said nothing. They stood, shaking their heads, knitting thoughts off their fingers at one another to the final stolid refusal like dumb oxen, to the release of their wills. It angered the director. It was worse than the snuffling shame of the paupers or the shabby compromises of the new poor. It angered him so that he lost his temper and threw himself against their dumb wills.
"Wasn't the child worth anything?" he shouted at Margaret. "Didn't his life have any value to you?"
Her mind ran his words into her fingers. There was no expression on her face. The sign would not make the same words that he said. She had to say the nearest thing. "Was the child expensive?" Then,
"Yes,"
came the toneless answer.
"The kid was very expensive. $25 when he was born. You don't have to worry about that debt. You don't have to be scared because it was paid already. We ain't crooks or nothing. We wouldn't bury a kid we didn't already pay for."
"What kind of people are you?" the director said.
"Printer,"
answered Margaret from her father's beaten fingers, proudly because the word had left his hands proudly.
"Her, she works in the mill, sewing."
The director was defeated. Against the far wall, standing on end so as to take as little space as possible, were the plain pine boxes. He shrugged and motioned with his head toward that corner. After the smooth, gleaming brown and gold of polished metal and varnished wood, the brilliant satins of ruched and folded lining, these plain boxes standing on end looked vaguely obscene. It was a thing he hated doing, giving the mourners the floor thing, but it was the one that got them all, that made them think. These boxes stood near a back door from which the carpet had been taken up. They were made out of the crudest wood, narrower than the average. Mourners always blanched at the thought of some rough workman's hands having to squeeze and push a little arm, twisting at the shoulder so that the body would fit. The dumbs took it like everyone else. They stood staring at those boxes, conquered, held by the large dead eyes of knotholes staring out of the unpainted wood. The director moved closer to the boxes and surreptitiously kicked one over. The clatter of the wooden coffin on the uncarpeted floor always brought a gasp from a mother and drove even the paupers back onto the carpet. But the dummies hadn't moved. Only the girl. The director realized that only she had heard the very effective hollow clatter. The kid was back on the carpet, but he could see that he had lost the parents. He looked at the girl bitterly.
"Why don't you tell those freaks?"
"Tell them what?"
Her eyes were dry and incurious. The man had taken an old-fashioned change purse out of his pocket and was slowly counting out money. $15. He put the bills, all ones, on one of the standing coffins and, with no motion wasted, bent down and picked up the lid of the fallen box, placed it on top, took up the box, biting his lip against his pain, and turned to leave. The director sprang ahead of him and opened the back door, and then he got out of the way, motioning Abel around and out that door with a toss of his head. The three of them left, disappearing in the heat shimmer of the alley without another word or sign. Following her father and trying to stay in the shade of the box, Margaret wondered idly what freaks were. Her parents were freaks. Another word for deaf, probably. It was only at the cemetery the next day that Margaret began to think of Bradley in his own person, not as a part of herself or as a voice screaming its intrusive will that she come and take him, dress him, lift him, wipe him, feed him, follow him. Sometimes he had seemed to her to be no more a person than his plate at the table, a place where he slept, a weight she must answer for. That morning, still muzzy with sleep, she had reached out toward his cot automatically, forming the words to wake him. Only then was there the shadowing of the thought that something had changed. And only when she saw the cot still folded against the door did she remember that he had died, and that his untied shoes had died also, and that she would no longer have to stop her play for his trip to the bathroom. The responsibility of Bradley was as dead as he. On the day they had brought the coffin home, she had had a wild crowding in of possibilities. There would be school now, a freedom to go or stay that was bounded only by the hours her parents worked. For a moment, she felt giddy and happy in her weightlessness. She wanted to run down the block, reveling in the unhampered, unimpeded freedom. It didn't matter that he could not follow, that he was lost, that he could no longer pick up something from Mr. Petrakis's bins or racks or touch the things on the counters. All of it was gone. Dead. She stood by the hole in which the coffin was going to be placed, watching the clever way the men used the ropes, and the thought of her new freedom came again. It came in a kind of violence this time, and a picture of it rose in her mind, very simple and frighteningly real. It was a clear, sharp memory of one of Bradley's hands. Nothing else. She saw it as it had reached out for her every day. A moist hand with barely visible soft blonde hairs on the back and down the backs of the fingers. Bradley had wavering, pudgy fingers, and their small nails were always crusted with food and dirt. In the vision of this hand, there was a sudden, stunning sense of loss. She stood staring blindly at the grave, and then at Janice, who had moved around until she was on the other side of the awful hole. Her mother's haunted face was full of the puffiness of unspent sleep. Her hair combed too quickly so that single hairs and strands of hair had escaped the pinning, and although she looked back at her daughter over the distance between them, she did not seem to see her. At Margaret's side, Abel was standing. She remembered how he had run down the stairs to where Bradley was lying, how he had scooped him up, shaking the dead body and howling, "Ed, Ed," in his unreal voice, a discordant, uncontrolled rage making those sounds no longer something that a person would laugh at, but something he might easily fear. The witnesses shocked, stared, and then moved away, frightened and murmuring, as Margaret and her mother came slowly down the stairs. It wasn't sorrow that they saw in Abel's face, but a simple, overwhelming rage. Then one of the men had come and said something about the cops being called, and he and another man took the body from Abel's arms. Abel, freed of the body he would protect even in death, seemed to go mad. The onlookers stood back, staring, amazed at the extravagant noise of his wildness. Everything he could not hear himself was loosed from him. He turned from the group of them and ran to the street door, kicking it closed. He kicked at the wall, pounded it, ran to the stairs and kicked at them, pounding on the rail and then at the steps with his fists. Then he ran back to the door and opened it again and smashed it closed. Back to the wall to pound and kick, bellowing all the time in his horrible voice. Back and forth he ran from wall to wall, while the witnesses stood stiff in the uproar. They did not notice the dead boy now. Only the man, as they waited, terrified of what he might do. Soon his voice warped and broke, but his mouth was still open. He didn't know that there was no sound coming. Back again he went to smash at the patient wall, one side, then the other, until he was too tired to go on. Then he stood, sweating, breathing loudly, clicking his tongue against the roof of his mouth, impatient to begin the rage again.
His hands were swollen and there were bruises beginning from the beating he had given them. The police had come then, and they had taken statements and made their useless notes. Above their daughter now, Janice and Abel began to argue about the fare they would need to get home. They wrangled back and forth, their faces thrust forward belligerently, their lips working clicks and half-words. Bringing the coffin from their home to the church and then to the cemetery had already come to a great deal of money. Abel's hands were moving from bitterness to bitterness, the raw, cutting words snapping from his damaged hands like blows. Close to Janice, the minister watched, sighing and now and then raising a hand to try to stop them. It was useless. In his embarrassment, his eyes found Margaret, and he smiled shyly at her and ventured the mixed words and sign that he sometimes used with the children of the deaf. She wondered, as she stood watching him, why he was trying to explain to her that sorrow can make the most loving people argue with each other. Looking at him, she felt a vague knowledge that if she had been his daughter, she would not have had to know that by herself. And there were other things, too. Police faces and witness faces, the coffin man face, the union faces and the doctor faces would be kept far away from the white curtained room in which he would keep her safe and a child. Poor man, she thought suddenly. He doesn't know about anything. It was then that she began to think about Bradley again. She saw his hand, with the same clear inner vision she had had before. Then she thought of Bradley's voice. To think of Bradley really was to hear him, whining or laughing or crying or making soft imitative sounds into his cupped hands. The sounds Bradley made had sometimes irritated her. Why was she no longer relieved that they were gone? It came to her that this part of Bradley, his sound, was a part known to her alone, annoying to her alone and now missed by her alone. The sound of Bradley's voice had been kept from the two grown-ups looming over his box. She felt a guilty pleasure in this secret. It seemed deserved, a reward for all the tending, the trailing, the buttoning and unbuttoning. Abel's tears were falling on her hair. The cold little drops of wetness warmed quickly in the heat and then rolled tickling into her scalp. She was afraid to move, or to move her hand to scratch where the tear was itching. They loved him, but they had never heard his voice, the sounds that were Bradley as much as his hand. Could they know him without knowing his voice? She saw the pudgy hand began to speak, his vague and halting sign. Margaret felt queasy and weak. She swayed, and Abel steadied her, pulling her body back slightly to lean its weight against his own. She fought free of his hand and then began to cry, calling Bradley's name as the coffin was lowered into the hole. It had dawned on her quite suddenly that Bradley, 4 years old and dead, had taken the sound of a human voice from the house. That after this, it would be she and she alone who would be sent against all the coffin men and the bill collectors and the police and all the words of the greedy mouths of the world. Forever. 10. It had been called depression, a thing Abel saw printed often now, and there was a sign for it among the educated ones at church. Having seen it as a sign, it was easier to recognize when it blew through the lips of other men in the shop, sometimes bitten off angrily. He thought it must really be bad if hearing were made frightened by it. He began to wait for it and to question the new things in his life for signs of it. But whatever it was, it waited its time with him, and he went on living as he had. With Bradley gone, there was a hollowing ache in sitting home after work. Even the thought of going home was not the comfort it had once been. But now he was happy in his work, so he found reasons for staying in the shop after many of the others had gone. The other men were decently considerate of him and respectful of his skill. Now, in the 15th year of his debt, the money taken from his paycheck no longer seemed to bother him, so when the first pay cut hit the shop, he was not perturbed. The call for fine work had shrunk. People who had once ordered engraved invitations now used simple printing. Magazines cut their color work, and advertisers used and reused the stock copy instead of changing it each month or week. There were times when men shook their heads over their lunchtime coffee in puzzlement. Sometimes Abel felt an actual fear around him. Then a big job would come in and an almost reckless gratitude with it, as if it had come from God to save them. The boss had given Abel parts of a strange picture book to make up. It used the finest paper and the highest quality of processing, yet the pictures, duo black for depth and contour, brilliantly clear and beautifully edited, were all pictures of poor and ugly people, ruined land, starving children, and of ragged, flat-faced women and groups of idle, burned-out men. What kind of people, he wondered, would want to have such a picture book? He had never questioned the meaning of what he printed, but these photographs seemed such a waste that he was afraid a mistake had been made. He wrote a note to Mr. Cotter about it and went up to the office with some of the photographs to show him. It must be a mistake. The men and women were facing front to the camera, and in some of the pictures the women's clothes were torn so that it was almost indecent. They looked not at themselves or one another, but outward, like the dead, through weather-wrinkled faces, no longer caring enough to smile or brighten themselves or attempt to please. He felt ashamed of them, whoever they were, and a little frightened. When Mr. Cotter read Abel's note, he smiled and then took up a piece of scrap and wrote, "This is a book about the Depression. It is a limited edition and very expensive, but it is a classic." "Classic?" "That means a great work by somebody famous. See how fine the photographs are? They are by a famous photographer." "Ugly," Abel wrote back. "Who will buy so ugly?" "Rich people." "Rich people very crazy if not to buy flower garden photograph or nice thing." The boss shrugged as though sharing a secret with Abel, and then Abel wrote again, "Pay is less because of depression. Is depression try to make all people like this?" Then Mr. Cotter shouted no at him and sent him back to work. Day after day, the staring, suffering people flowed through the various photo processes, imposing themselves as negatives, positives, red impressions, and black impressions on the part of Abel's mind that had to judge them as work. Usually, he didn't remember from one week to the next the subject of what he was doing. He remembered the problems conquered or compromised with, the smooth insets that had so resisted being cut round, or the very faint moiré he had allowed himself in the background of an off-center piece of work. Now he dreamed of the faces he was multiplying 3,000 times upon the world. They stared from his sleep, their eyes following the sip of water to his lips or the warm coat he put on. And they were silent. Their faces seemed not to be the faces of hearing people, those with mouths always open to suck and push the word-crammed breath in and out between themselves and the world. These mouths were shut, the lips locked. Some of the mouths seemed worn away with locking until they were only ridges, held bitter and straight. In his dreams, Janice and Margaret looked out from those pictures in faded cotton sack clothes and lank hair. And at church, they began to feel the slow, long pull of anxiety as the world closed in upon the deaf. The watch factory went out of business, and for a while, deaf and hearing alike turned confidently to doing watch repair at home. But no one came. The body shops and the boiler rooms and the stamping mills and the print shops, the thundering, crashing hub places of machine production, where the deaf had found themselves small places of advantage over the noise-tormented hearing, slowed, and stopped. They learned to spell layoff when it was a random misfortune. But misfortune turned in the year of 1933 to a one-tone head sound, heard through the skull and in the marrow of the bones, nerves or no, so that the deaf heard it. The Hacker brothers were out walking the streets. Minifee and his son sat home. Callender went to his family and learned to eat little and quickly. The Dawes, all of them, left, and people said they were beggars through the South somewhere where no one knew them. Nina Alford said, "Why not beg if there is nothing in the house? Take a sign, 'I am deaf,' and sit on the street with it." And her father beat her so that she was out 2 Sundays from church. Some people dropped church because they didn't have the clothes. Then people lost touch with them and felt ashamed. When the fall term of school started the first autumn after Bradley's death, Margaret had begun in school. She was 9.5 years old then. At first, it was humiliating to be sorted with a class of 6-year-olds to learn to read and write, but she found herself not alone. There were many immigrant children on Vandalia Street, and they too came as beginners. The first grade had its own back section of foreign-born. In this polyglot buzz of wild curiosity and brutal, undirected energy that seethed and spat and pummeled and scuffled around her, Margaret sat primly, a foreigner. She hated them. They waved their fingers as their fathers did, bargaining in the street or talking to a neighbor, hand to the listener's lapel as though without touch one might doubt the speaker's existence. They moved their eyes and their mouths widely, acting and reacting as their mothers did, as though a word by itself might have no meaning. They stank of rotten cheese and spoiled grease. Their sounds were ugly, their gestures obscene. Margaret alone sat motionless, keeping her hands quietly in her lap when she was not writing. She alone made no comment with twists of her mouth or raising of her eyebrows in the way of the others. By December, the back section had moved into the second grade room and the combat of the cat and the rat was given over to our country and our home. The teachers spoke gently to Margaret, praising her neatness and good manners. Her hair, which had darkened to a rich brown, was kept in 2 long braids that now hung below her waist, and she spent her Christmas dime on hair ribbons after having visited every ribbon counter on the avenue. Janice was home. She was sitting on a kitchen chair looking strange because it was still light outside. She had not taken off her coat or hat, and everything in the house was as it had been in the morning. Margaret went over to where she sat and touched her shoulder. When she looked up, Margaret said,
"What happened? Are you sick?"
Janice waved her away impatiently.
"The bonus," she said. "The bonus is gone."
Then Margaret sat down too.
"Who said?"
"They lowered all the quota, and now if anybody goes over the quota, they won't pay anymore. And when a machine breaks, they won't fix it. They'll just fire the girl on it."
She came alive suddenly, her sign hard and violent in Margaret's face.
"You remember, I made more over quota than any girl in the section, and now they made me the same like any new girl one day working."
She began to weep, hugging her stomach and swaying, the tears running down her face and dropping from the edge of her jaw. Because bonus was what bought the clothes they wore to church, bonus was a special kind of money. Common wages could pay for common food, school dresses hard with sizing, things that kept people but did not change them. Bonus was the power that transformed them the moment they put on their church clothes and left Vandalia Street. Bonus was what made them better than their weekday selves, more deserving of the stain.